Wait, you can read?
Well, you know, that Spot runs like crazy, and you would not believe the trouble he gets into.
All right, go ahead.
I read the news.
Okay.
Video game news. Grand Theft Auto 6. Have you heard the budget for this thing?
I know that it's been in the works for about 37 years.
Yeah. They're looking at $1.5 billion, but they said when all is said and done, they're looking at about $3 billion.
Are they going to sell $3 billion worth of a video game?
Well, it is currently the most lucrative, most profitable entertainment product ever created. It's made more than any film, any video, any piece
after
of recorded.
Us.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
After you and
true.
I.
It's true. After, you know, because this doesn't just make itself, people. There's a team behind the scenes. We never even say what it is anymore.
We should start from the beginning. Welcome. This is episode. What are we at? 373.
Yeah.
Of your On Taking Pictures program. I am Bill Wadman. That is Jeffrey Sidoris.
If
you're newly here, welcome. And you need to go back to episode one before you're going to get any of the jokes.
Right. Which was April of 2012, I think, was the first episode.
Wow. Yeah. 14 years of episodes to go through. Anyway, but here we are.
I just thought that was wild.
Are you a big video game player still?
I'm not a big video game player. And the type of games that I play has changed. I play more narrative games now, single player. I don't play multiplayer games anymore. I'm currently playing Cyberpunk 2077, which is this big, you know, RPG set in a post-apocalyptic yada, yada, yada. That features Keanu Reeves as Johnny Silverhand.
Okay.
In the thing, and then they
real
did an
original
expansion.
Name they came up with there.
Yeah, they did an expansion with Idris Elba as the antagonist, which I haven't gotten to yet. That's another whole other area of the thing. But I put them on easy difficulty, and I go, I want a story with a little interactive quality to it.
Okay.
You know, I want sort of a movie with a few choices on how I move through it, and then I'm good.
Right. You don't need the 27 side quests to get through a door.
No, nor do I need all of the like Twitch skill multiplayer, you know, being called out by a 12-year-old because I can't shoot as fast or whatever. I don't need any.
Hey, boomer.
Yeah, right. Wow. Just kind of rolled off your tongue right there.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I realized a good reason to upgrade to Tahoe just now.
I still have not upgraded yet.
Either have I.
Oh.
But I found a good reason to.
But certainly not the consistency of the icons.
Well, so a young friend of mine bought a new computer. She's going to grad school.
Okay.
And, let me just say, going from a 2019 Intel 13-inch Pro with a touch bar.
Oh, so, right.
Okay.
Right.
So you picture that.
Yeah.
With, I think, 256 and 8 gigs of RAM. This is what I made them buy.
Were you dressed in your SS uniform at the side? You forget this one?
You are. You know.
Wow.
14-inch MacBook Pro with the M5 Pro chip, 48 gigs of RAM.
Oh my gosh.
2 terabytes of drive space.
All for the low, low price of $7,800.
It was about $3,000.
Yeah. But that's, arguably that's the last computer you need for a good many years.
This is the thing. She's going to be in grad school for 5 years. So this will cover her for 5 years. And have enough RAM that if things really go in the direction where people start running some models locally that are a little smaller, more compact, like she could do that, you know? She's also a fledgling photographer, and she was working in Lightroom on the old Intel computer.
Mm.
And last night, for the first time, she opened them up in the new computer.
Right.
And needless to say, she was excited and awed.
How many gigs of RAM? 24, 48. 48. 48 gigs of RAM. I've never had a machine with 48 gigs of RAM.
You know, well, I'm gonna get to that in 2 seconds. So this is what I told her to get. And so she got it. She likes it. But she wrote me yesterday. She uses a Fuji XT50, which is the little version of the XT5.
Right.
And she said, "Oh my God, the I can preview RAW files." And I was like, "Wait, what?" And apparently,
but you couldn't preview them on the Intel?
They wouldn't show up in Finder. Thumbnails wouldn't.
Oh.
Yeah.
What is that? So that's the feature in Tahoe?
Apparently, in a recent dot release of Tahoe, added support for compressed Fuji RAW files in Finder and preview. Wow. Which I know is a small, stupid thing, but when you just...
Well, not if you're a Fuji user.
Right. You just dump a bunch of pictures into a folder and you can't see what the hell any of them are until you open them up in some program. It's really annoying to like sort things through or just say, oh yeah, these are from this shoot and this was from the, you know, I mean, just to be able to do all that kind of organization stuff in Finder, you couldn't do it.
Wow.
So apparently it got added, I think, sometime in January. Somebody can correct us. But
that's kind of neat.
I was thinking that was actually kind of neat.
Yeah.
But
I'm still, you know, I don't like the liquid glass.
Yeah, no one does.
I don't like the inconsistency of, you know, the icon design, number one, and then menu icon. Like everything's got an icon now so that nothing stands out.
Apparently there is a terminal command to turn those off inside the menus.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Go do Google.
Is it all or nothing? So you turn them all off, or is it only?
I think it's an all or nothing kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I would almost rather have all off than all on, right? If you have the choice.
I mean, I guess there are some in the things that I'm just looking at like messages.
And then
I
read this article. They use the same icons for multiple functions.
Yeah, because how many freaking icons are there in SF? Whatever it is, whatever the little icon font is.
Yeah.
They're not going to have 7,500 things that all are perfect
for
each use.
But then make them stand out. Don't use them twice because then it's confusing.
It's bad UI, which is sad because this, you know, the old human interface guidelines, the old HIG used to be, you know, the thing that people look to for good interface guidelines.
Well, and maybe with Alan Dye gone now, maybe they will address
Alan
that.
Alan Dye died?
No, he's not gone. I mean, not dead. He What? Okay, I see what you did there. Do you have that rim shot handy on your fancy keyboard?
I don't have any drums on this.
Or a
keyboard.
Trombone? Do you have a trombone handy? That was you. You're not fooling anybody.
You got me.
Hey, I was on the drive this morning.
Okay.
Driving Adrian to the train station, and a Kate Bush song came on, "Running Up That Hill," because that's the only one they ever play.
Sure.
And I was thinking about her. And people like her for whom, you know, there was no doubt of what she was going to be in life, right? I mean, she wrote Man with the Child in His Eyes when she was 14, 15.
Okay.
You know, Prodigy on the piano, similar to somebody like Freddie Mercury, who wrote, you know, famously Bohemian Rhapsody when he was 16 years old. There was no doubt of what he was going to do with his life. And I wondered, when we were talking about, was there a tension between having almost a destiny, you know, sort of out in front of you, and maybe you go, I'm really good at this stuff, but I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to do this, but all of my skills, all of my talent, all of my even intuition maybe is leading me to this thing, but I kind of don't want to. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. I can imagine that I think there are certain people with certain skills. I can imagine a musician who, it's funny, a friend of mine has perfect pitch and is a musician, which is a very handy thing to have as a musician.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than perfect pitch and you work at a jackhammer all day.
Well, that's the thing. His brother has better pitch than him and is not a musician.
Well, how can it be more? Is there more perfect?
Oh, sure, perfecter? Sure. I mean, you know, there's the put Jacob Collier at one end of the scale.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay.
You know, there's, you know, perfect pitch there's a thing called relative pitch. So I can't say perfect pitch is relative, but I think there are people for whom it's, even more vivid and more precise.
You can play a chord in front of this guy and he goes, oh, well, it's this, 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 and this that make up that chord.
The day that I first hung out with my friend, I was listening to Take Six. Do you remember who Take Six
yeah,
is?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
This is when I was at UConn and I saw, it's my friend Frank Piccarazzi. I saw him play drums in a band. There was a car painting company called the Earl Scheib.
Oh yeah, sure. Okay. Any car, any color, yeah. $49.95.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember those commercials. Sure.
So they had a band called the Earl Scheib Five. Yeah. And my
oh my god, that's great.
And then this was at UConn and
the Earl Scheib Five.
Yeah, it was great.
Oh my gosh.
And my sister, this is wow, little rabbit hole here. My sister and I, there was a guy on campus who was sort of a seventh or eighth year senior.
Wow. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Named Jess Yandow. We'll have to look him up, whoever okay. he is. And he had long hair and he was like really handsome and he slept with all the girls and he wrote poetry.
Right.
And my sister and I found him hilarious. Just like the idea that he existed.
Wait, was he in the band? Was he?
No. He was just on campus. This guy, Jess Yandow. He was in Playgirls, like Guys of America's Campuses that year or whatever.
Right.
You know, like okay. He's that guy. Right.
Like Fabio or something.
Yes, exactly like that, but with less muscles. Right. I feel bad.
Fabio Light.
Right now, somewhere in Nebraska, Jess Yandow's listening to On Taking Pictures, being like, mind blown.
I had muscles.
Wait a minute. I just came here for a photography show. It's his first show,
totally
too.
It worked out. I had muscles.
He was like, I was going to go start with episode one, like you told me to 10 minutes ago.
Screw you guys.
So anyway, my sister and I just got a kick out of Jess Yandow's like whole thing. So this was early on in my freshman year. It was my sister's senior year at UConn. And we went to a poetry reading because Jess Yandow was going to be reading poetry and we wanted to go check
right.
it out.
You had to see this for yourself.
Yeah. So we went and at the end of the poetry reading, they had musicians and it was this band, the Earl Scheib Five. And really good people. I'm still friends with most of the band today. But the drummer was really, really great. My friend Frank's a really good drummer. A drummer with perfect pitch. Isn't that crazy?
Right.
anyway, he turns out he went to the same dorm cafeteria that I did. So the next day, I was watching them play that night and thinking, man, these guys are good. The next day I go and I'm putting my tray away and Frank comes up to put his tray down right next to me. And I said, excuse me, you were playing, you know, drums in that band yesterday. And we became fast friends. Mm-hmm. And we started talking and I was using a music notation software called Finale, which is now defunct.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Which is
sure.
really sad. Which at the time was like a $300 app, which in 1993 is what, like $27,000?
Yeah, right. It's either your car or buy this app.
But you could buy it EDU for a couple $100 or something. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I had a copy of Finale. He didn't know how to use it. I was the computer nerd. And I was like, oh, I could teach you how to use Finale. Why don't you come over to my dorm room later? I'll show you a few tricks. So he came over and we were talking. And I said, you really have perfect pitch because it came up. And I said, yeah. And I said, hold on a second. And I backed it up on one little chunk of a Take Six song where they just like build up this big chord, like bum, 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 bow, you know, like big kind of horn section.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hit pause and he walks over to the piano and he goes, bum, 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 bow, and just plays it. And I was like, oh
wow.
My God.
Now, was that the first time you had experienced something like that in real life?
Yeah, I
like
think it might have
that
been.
Kind of skill?
Yeah. I mean, at Berkeley, like half the people I went to school with did. But at UConn, it was, you just see that kind of thing. And it's not disparaging to anybody who has a skill like that. It's like watching somebody who can sit down with colored pencils and, you know, draw the crumpled up plastic bag next to them. And it's perfect.
Right. 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 Right.
It's like, how do you
CJ
do
Hendry,
that?
For those of you who want to see something like that, go look up CJ Hendry.
Yes. She's incredible. And I look at that kind of thing and I just think, if I had that skill, would it feel special if you had it?
Well, and this is kind of the what I was getting around to with Adrian this morning is, you know, did Kate Bush or, you know, even Freddie, did they see themselves as special at the time, or was it just something that they innately knew how to do? And well, I'll do this because I know how to do this. I don't know.
They were just as confused by their skills as anyone is about their own. It's just that their skills happen to be objectively further up on a scale.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're a really good baseball player in high school and you can hit the ball better than the next person, you know, do you even know that you're special? You're just trying to hit the ball.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you wake up one? Did Shohei Ohtani wake up one morning and go, yes, I am the greatest player to ever play the game?
Exactly.
Or has he just been working at it?
Yeah.
I don't
and
know.
He's just trying to pitch the next pitch and get another. He's a pitcher, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's just trying to pitch another strike. Maybe he does it better than everybody else, but that doesn't mean he's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean he doesn't know what it's like to fail or be frustrated by not being able to find the thing he's trying to find. I understand what you're saying. It's, but
go ahead. Go ahead.
I think we also, we lean into the things that we are good at.
Well, okay. So this is segue. This was unplanned, but, you know, this kind of gets into where I'm at in my life right now. I've decided to walk away from painting for a while.
Okay.
Because it just doesn't bring me joy anymore. I the way I do it. Okay. And I feel like I wrote something about it. If you're interested, go listen to the last iteration on my Substack, or, you know, read it if you'd rather read it. Anyway, the point is I can kind of make something that sort of kind of works pretty consistently.
Yep.
But I don't want to make something that sort of kind of works. I want to make something that surprises me. I want to make something that takes me someplace in the making of it. And that's not happening right now. And it hasn't been happening for a while. And the only thing I can think of at the moment is to take a step back and either come at it from a different direction or leave that behind entirely and try something else that might scratch that itch. And I don't know what that is yet.
What was
Have
the
you
last
ever been
time
in that position?
Yeah, constantly. But what I mean, we'll get to that momentarily. What was the last time you made something that did surprise you?
Years ago.
Give me years, like before you met me.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Probably that first batch of work when I was learning how to fuse analog and digital. So this would have been, you know, 2009, 2010, 2011, that period in there was a lot more fun because it was new. It was, there was discovery. There was, transformation. You know, I was learning new stuff, and I feel like for the last too many years, I've just been doing the same kind of thing again and again and again. The results are slightly different. Some are better than others. They all might be crap. They all might be great. I don't know. So two things have happened. I've lost objectivity around the things that I make, and the making itself doesn't bring me the kind of joy that it used to.
I think it's something interesting that you just said. You said that it happened when you were learning something new.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that that is a big part of it. I think that
that's the tell.
I think there's multiple different ways to go about this. One is the learning something new. I think when you are in a state of discovery,
yeah,
that implies that you're out of your comfort zone, and you know, by definition, and
sure,
and means that you're going to go down paths that you haven't been down before because you'd never been there before.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's true. I think that, and I hesitate to mention the second one, which is you were a lot younger then.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, our brains change as time goes on. And not to say that, you know, old dogs, new tricks isn't a thing, but I think that you have to make more of a concerted effort.
Yeah.
I think there's less, curiosity as we get older.
Yeah. Which affects neuroplasticity, which affects the passing of time and the relative passing of time.
I think there's less openness to trying new things and failing at them because you think I'm old. I don't want to look like a fool .
Yeah. But the irony there is I have nothing left to prove and I'm in a position where I've got time. I've got resources. Why not? Like, arguably, sure. I'm in the best position I've ever been in my life to learn new things.
And it's not like you were if the painting thing was how you made a bunch of money. And if you changed anything, it could ruin a good thing.
Yeah.
Economically.
Yeah.
Then you have all of this incentive to just, put out another album like the last one, Billy Joel.
Yeah. Right? Which is its own kind of trap, right? I mean, I know a couple painters who they want to do something different, but their galleries are like, we're selling this stuff. Yep. So just keep making this stuff.
Yep. I mean, I guess in those situations, you could continue to do. I mean, I could for instance, let's say somebody likes the kind of portraits I take, some, environmental, blah, blah, blah. That one person in the world who wants me to take an environmental portrait of them. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean trying new stuff doesn't mean that I can't go back to that preset from 5-10 years ago.
Right.
If I wanted to take a picture like I took 15-20 years ago, I could shoot the way I did, post-process it the way I did, and I'll probably get pretty darn close to it. And I bet you I'd be able to do it pretty quickly too, right? I did a lot
but
of that.
Would it bring you the same kind of excitement, joy, et cetera, that it did 15 years ago? Or would you just be going through the motions for the result?
Well, time away means that I might actually enjoy it more than I think that I would, mm-hmm. right? If it's something that I hadn't done in a while. I'm just saying that if somebody really, it's not like if you put away the way you paint now, you can't go back to it.
Yeah.
You're not closing that door.
No, I just think I need to go to another room for a while
and totally.
let that field go fallow to borrow that metaphor.
Sure.
Or, embark on something, some other form of discovery that jumpstarts and maybe feeds back into where I came. You know what I mean?
It's sure.
The newness is what I think, to your point, is what's exciting and the uncertainty and sure. There's a little bit of uncertainty. The gel is going to do what it's going to do. The paint's going to do what it's going to do. If you scritch through too much, you're going to, blow through a layer.
But it's uncertainty within an envelope.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. It would be like you going back and doing, the standard sort of cubicle corporate, two light setup headshots. Yeah, you can do those all day long and you're sure. really good at it.
Yep.
You're really good at it. But at some point you're on autopilot.
Absolutely. And you feel stifled by the process.
Yeah. Whereas, you and I have been talking about your movie lately and there's excitement in your voice. There's frustration in your voice. There's discovery in your voice. You can hear that you're having to deal with all these things that you haven't dealt with before. And yeah, it's a pain in the ass. But in that pain in the ass, it's kind of exciting and I really like it.
Well, yeah, I had a shoot last week, which we can just discuss if you want to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that finding those new things, whether it's, if you're in a computer situation, using different software to play with stuff, mm-hmm. Not necessarily new tools, but just new ways of using your tools. If you're a soft light person, try using some hard light. If you're an environmental person, try using a flash. If you're stuck on flashes and lighting everything precisely, just try using available light for a little while.
And I love what you just said. It's rotating the kaleidoscope. It's not abandoning everything. It's coming at it from a different tack. Yeah. My therapist suggested, we were talking about a lot of this, and she said, okay, she's like, I'd like you to try something. I'd like you for every day for the month of May, 15 to 30 minutes sketch. Solid, 15 to 30 minutes. Doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter what the media is. Doesn't matter, hard pencil, soft pencil. Doesn't sure. matter. Whatever. Just sketch for 15 to 30 minutes every day and see how you feel. I have been. Yeah, okay. I have been. And, it's nowhere near what I used to be able to do. And I posted one of the sketches on Substack and one of the people who subscribes, lovely comment. She said, be kind to yourself. Those muscles will dance again. Don't compare yourself to where you were at your fittest, compare yourself to a week ago.
Yeah.
You know, yep. don't go back and go, well, I'm crap because I can't do what I did 35 years ago when I was doing it every day for the previous 20 years or whatever it was.
But isn't it interesting, though, how quickly it can come back?
Very.
I mean, I don't play piano the way I did X years ago. I just, you know, I used to play more and whatever. And I, you know, there's things that my fingers, I'm trying to still get them to do, mm-hmm. but I am way closer to it tonight than I was 2 months ago when I got my piano.
Yeah.
So it's,
you know, that incremental building, isn't it?
Yeah. It's all in there, right? You know, it's all still in there waiting for you to use it.
Mm.
And I think that maybe as we get older, we forget that
do we discount it? Is it memory? Do we remember ourselves as better or worse than we used to be? And that affects what we're willing to do now.
I think as we get older, we judge ourselves more.
Mm.
I think when you're younger, you just do it and you judge less. And as you get older, you do less and you judge more.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we find things to rest on it. Well, if I don't do it well, then I'm not going to be able to do this.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're younger and you're learning this stuff, it's just, I'm going to go do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about it. I was burning through sketch pads like they were going out of style.
Exactly.
I wasn't thinking about monetizing or, you know, funnels or, you know, any of this other garbage.
And that's me messing around in DaVinci Resolve, right? It's just like, you're trying something new. You know, there was a Jacob Collier, the musician guy, was on, at Berkeley this last week. Gave him his doctorate graduation thing. He was the guest speaker.
Did he perform as well?
Usually they don't perform, but I think he does he has this thing where he makes the audience sing notes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We saw him at the 9:30 and he did that. Yeah. It was actually a lot of fun.
Oh, he's great. It's funny. Conrad gets really upset about the singing thing. She's just like, I get it, but just sing your songs. Do one of those. I don't need three of those in a night, which is really funny. But he got up there and I'll have to find the clip and see if I can add it to show notes. But he got up and he was talking about how all of the things that make people a good musician, and let's insert artists instead of musician. And he was, you know, it was like, empathy and trust and irreverence and reverence. And he just started listing all of these qualities. He said, these are also the qualities that make somebody a good person. And he quoted, I think, Victor Wooten, the bassist. He said, we don't need more good musicians in the world. We need more good people.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Write that one down, kids.
Yeah. And I watched it literally 10 minutes before we started. And it just, man, it hit me a little bit, you know? I think that that's true. I think we need to be more compassionate to ourselves about what we're trying to accomplish. I don't think that Michael Jordan or Michelangelo or Bill Evans, I think they were doing what they did. I'm sure that they were frustrated with themselves at times. I'm sure sometimes they were thinking about how the things they did fit into a larger society. But I think mostly they were just painting and playing and, you know.
Yeah.
It's the experience of doing it is the reason why we do it. We don't do it for the final results. If that's the case, then we're all in mid-journey making images and that's photography. So it's not just about the final image. It's about the experience of having done it. And it's about the things that we do as humans and the time that we have here. I don't know.
I think there's a lot to that. I do too. I have a neighbor. His name is Gary.
Okay.
And Gary is a librarian at the Library of Congress.
Okay. Cool.
And,
cool job.
Yeah. He's in the periodicals division. And we he's kind of my movie buddy and we buy movies for each other and, you know, he'll buy things and go, oh, I've got duplicates of this. So every once in a while, he'll drop off a box of DVDs going, these are all duplicates. If you want them, great. If you don't, you know, donate them. And we've been talking about coming down for a visit for months. And this past Saturday, he said, hey, I'm going to be I'm going to be at work on Saturday. Do you want to come down with me? And I said, yeah, yeah, I'd love to. So I went
to take your neighbor to work day.
I know. Went to over to his house. He lives like four houses down. And we took the train down and he showed me around. And a couple things. Gary loves his job, loves being a librarian, at the Library of Congress. And he's been there for, you know, 38 years or something, and has seen many technologies come and go, many changes. And we got into first of all, it's a massive complex. If you've never been to the Library of Congress, there are three buildings, two main buildings. There's the Jefferson, which is kind of what you would recognize as the library, right? And then there's the Madison, which is the periodicals and sound recordings and moving image recordings, which, oh, get this. If you want to go listen to something, they have these little booths in the recorded, you know, sound and recordings area. And if you want to listen to something, they'll put it on for you. But if they don't have it there and it's in the Culpeper storage in Virginia, they'll call them up. They'll put it on at that location and stream it to your booth.
Oh, that's awesome.
In DC. So you can listen to
that's
it.
That's awesome. So cool. That's interesting and new because back in the day I had there was a radio recording that my grandfather played on. That I wanted to try to get that they had at the Library of Congress. And I paid, I think, $40 for them to record it to a DAT for me and send it to me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so now you can, if it's depending on rights, you can pop in a thumb drive and scan things. And, you know,
anyway,
they'll give you a digital. Anyway, so I'm wandering around and I finally get to Gary. And he had to go help somebody. And one of his colleagues was like, you know, he's so happy that you're here. He's so happy to show this to you and just effusive about how lovely he was as not just a librarian, but as a human being. And he's so helpful and just wants people to be excited about materials, whether that's books or recordings or movies. He's just in his element. Like there is no better place for him to be. And it was just so nice to see that in full swing in person.
Sure.
Rather than the abstract of us sort of talking about it as we're walking our dogs up and down the street each night.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, seeing somebody in their element doing their thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of, you know, fly on the wall, watching him help other people and hearing, you know, how sort of gently, but enthusiastically he explains processes that are unfamiliar to people and where to find things. And, you know, then there was the whole walking through the newspaper division and the magazines and I mean, it was just
I'm
a
sure there's bowels
experience.
And tunnels and all kinds of
oh
places
my gosh.
To go. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely
yeah.
Incredible. So I'm going to go back down and we're actually going to record some stuff in situ at the library. So that'll be at a later date.
Is
but it
Gary,
was so much fun.
Retiring soon? I mean, how does that work?
You know, he doesn't want to. I mean, he can. He's at the point where he can take his retirement, but he would like to hold on as long as possible because he gets so much joy from it. He
yeah.
loves going to work.
Oh man, imagine that.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
well, and that was the thing. That was the
I shouldn't
the,
say
the
that
theme
I,
of this whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
there are people for whom work is not work.
Adrian is one of those people. She loves what she does, and
yeah.
her job is important. She makes a difference. It's, you know, she's leaving the world in a little bit of better place than what she found it, and she gets a ton of joy from it. That is so foreign to me on a lot of occasions.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is ironic because, I mean, looking at, say, you, there's no boss with a cigar in the other room cracking down on you.
No. No. There's not.
The boss, the little boss is inside your head.
Yes. Thank you, Stephen Pressfield.
yeah. It's a complicated thing. I envy those people who are in love with what they do that much. I don't know. Maybe it's like there's this I constantly have a frustration and a desire, a need. I don't know. I would love to be able to ignore external validation. I would love to be able to say, I'm going to make the things
I... crack
that
code. write a book or send me an email, because I would love to be on that one.
You know what I'm saying, though?
Yes, I do.
It's, you know, if I was on a desert island making the pictures or the movies or the whatever, making the music that I want to make, and didn't give a, there was nobody to give a crap about the things that I was making, would I judge myself as harshly as I do now?
I suspect no. I suspect that a lot of this, for a lot of people, I mean, I'm sure there are people, you know, sort of nodding their heads listening, that the external validation or lack thereof is such an incredible either motivator or deterrent for what we decide to do.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. 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 There's a story I got to tell you, but I'll tell you offline, because I just, this is one that I can't tell you online. But,
listeners,
just sometimes there are moments where you meet people and you have conversations that just sort of feed into your worst fears.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the person you're talking to might not be their goal.
That wasn't the motivation.
Yeah. And yet that's how it feels, you know, when it's actually happening. It's interesting. Being a human in this world is a really interesting thing. And having all these external inputs and your internal inputs and trying to weigh the importance of any one of them at any particular time in your life.
Let me ask you something. Do you ever think about the time in which you are on this planet? Like if you were your age now in, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, when you were in your 20s.
Yeah, right.
Maybe you're in your 20s or 30s in that late 60s, early 70s, you know, singer-songwriter, Laurel Canyon sound kind of thing. Do you think
would I be Jackson Brown? I think yes. Thank you, Jeffrey, for bringing that up.
Well, sorry, that's never going to happen. You know, is there a thing where, because I think about this a lot, where I just got slotted in the wrong slot.
Sure.
You know, if I had, and you know, it's wishful thinking, of course. Maybe you would have amounted to nothing. Maybe I would have amounted to nothing. Maybe, you know, but would it be okay to amount to nothing without the imagined judgment of the world at large, who can see everything you do at any given time?
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying the global internet panopticon.
Yes.
Is part of the problem.
I think it is. It builds in a society of comparison. It builds in well, look what this person's doing. Well, they're not really doing that. They just want you to think they are doing that. You know, like,
sure.
I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know. I don't know where it all plays in. I just know that, you know, as I have pulled back from the news and social media and, you know, not having Threads and not having the Instagram app.
And there are some inane conversations on Threads.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I am much happier and much more. I'm much more interested in what I want to do and in the things that I'm doing.
Sure.
Without that.
Sure.
I'm more interested in the kind of writing that I do. I'm more interested in, you know, maybe I'm going to take a class. Maybe I'll take an encaustic class, or maybe I'll take a glass blowing class or something like that, just to, you know, as you pointed out earlier, get back to that sort of discovery of being off balance and not knowing.
In today's world, if you were required for the things that you do when you're offline in that way, to be seen and noticed and, that the world needed to be aware of them for whatever reason, you know, to make a living or whatever.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think that there are people who feel as if I can't not be doing those things, because then I'm completely out of touch with my audience that I eventually have to try to sell this to or whatever.
Well, yeah. I mean, the heyday of Casey Neistat doing those daily vlogs for, what did he do them for, 900 days or something? Some crazy number?
Yeah. Yeah.
First of all, I don't think my life is that interesting to be film-worthy each day.
No. Yeah. To be fair, I don't think Casey Neistat's was a lot of days, but yeah.
Yeah, but he did it anyway.
Sure.
And at some point, your life just becomes one sort of performative event after another.
Yeah. Yep.
And I don't think that's, I mean, if you can do it and sustain it, great. But for me, that wouldn't be healthy.
It's very Warholian, isn't it? Right. You know, it's like 15 minutes of fame. Everyone wants to be a celebrity.
Yeah. And, you know, it worked out for him. You know, he sold his company for, what, $30 million or something to CNN. Okay, good job.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but what is he doing now?
What was the cost? Yeah, right. I mean, what have you done for me lately, Casey?
I guess that, you know, you could look at that and say, you know, in 20 years, is anybody even going to remember any of that stuff? Is anybody going to remember any of us in 20 years, I guess, is the bigger
I think
question.
They'll remember it as sort of a milestone of when – you know, vlogging hit the mainstream.
Sure.
I think you could make a pretty strong case that he was, if not the one, he was one of those people who took vlogging from a nerdy niche to something that everybody aspired to do for a while.
Sure, sure. Yeah, like the Vlog Brothers.
What is that?
Hank Green and his brother John Green. You know, they're the people who do the, "Hi, John." And then they start talking to each other. And then the next one is the other guy, John, talking to Hank. "Hey, Hank, I've been thinking about what you just wrote." They do like
okay. Yeah.
They've been doing it since 2007 or something.
Yeah.
They're great. Oh, speaking of which, did you see? So Hank Green, one of those two guys I was just talking about, is like a science educator nerd guy.
Okay.
And he took, so he was looking at all the great pictures because 18,000 pictures from the Artemis mission got dumped onto, I hate saying the word dropped. Were released by NASA onto some website. So you can go
through.
Oh, sure.
They'll release the Artemis files.
Yeah. But and a lot of the pictures they took, they would do on, I mean, storage was not the problem, right? They're only going to be there once. So there was lots of, you know, of
right.
certain pictures. So they'd be taking pictures of the Earth and they'd be blowing out 30 frames or whatever it is. Some person on the internet took those frames and turned them into an animation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And one set of the pictures was when they were on the night side of the Earth at really high ISO. So the sun is on the far side of the Earth, right? Mm-hmm. So you see like a little bit of sunlight along the edge, but mostly it's sort of the Earth in shadow. But it was so high ISO that there was enough light bouncing off the moon to light up the dark side of the Earth.
I saw that photo. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I saw that photo.
So someone took those, animated them, and you can see satellites.
Oh, wow.
Moving. Like a sea of satellites around the edge, dancing back and forth, like left and right past each other.
Wow.
And I thought, man, I don't think I've ever actually seen that before. And I don't think anybody's seen that before. Because they're, you know, they're halfway to the moon, but using a, you know, whatever it is, you know, they're not halfway to the moon. They're 60,000 miles away taking pictures of the Earth, but there's enough that the light from the sun on the other side bounced off some, you know, super shiny part of a satellite enough to have like one pixel light up for a few seconds.
And this was with that, the old Nikon that we were talking about a couple episodes
ago? Yeah, with the D5 and probably whatever the R9 or 7 or whatever, or not R. What is the...
Shoots at 2 million ISO or something, you said?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the D5. And then whatever the... What is the... Oh, all the Nikon fans are yelling at me right now. Whatever the new Nikon thing is, the Z9. There you go, Z9.
Z9.
Anyway, it was super cool. And, you know, things like that, you know, we wouldn't have seen those 60 years ago or 30 years ago before the internet really took off, you know, but here we are and some guy can share that and millions of people get to look at it. You know, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a thing. Okay. So can I tell you about my shoot the other day?
Yes, please. This is your movie shoot.
Yeah. So what I decided,
hold on. Let me give you a little backstory. For those of you who are just joining us for the first time, Bill has written a couple scripts, a couple, right? Three scripts, and is putting together funding to shoot one of the scripts as an indie film, and has been shooting. Are they test scenes or are these scenes that are going to be in the final?
I have a test, I think, we'll get to that in a second.
All right, go ahead.
So
there you go.
Thank you. Thank you for the summation of the story up till now.
Thank you for the warm introduction.
Previously on Bill's Movie Adventures. So I decided I've been frustrated.
You could start a little thing and just call it the B-roll because you're built. Right?
Okay. It's not a bad idea.
Damn it.
So I wrote this movie. I'm trying to make this movie. I've raised what to some would seem like a bunch of money, but it's about half the money that I need to do it the way I want to do it. Mm-hmm. But I'm frustrated by the fact that I can't do it right. I've got money, but I can't do the thing right. Cause I only got half the money. Now there's a lot of people in this situation who would just start shooting the movie.
Yeah. Or maybe shoot like a sizzle reel or something to shop around.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So what I decided to do was to shoot a scene, as basically a sizzle reel, as like a proof of concept, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the story. Yes. If you really want to read the script as an investor, I can let you read the script if that'll, you know, get you on board.
Yeah.
But then people would say, yeah, but what's it going to look like? What's it going to be like? Is this going to work in real life? Like, have you ever directed anything? You know, all that kind of, all those
questions. It's an indie film. We're not making Titanic.
I know. So I decided a few weeks, about 2.5 weeks ago, I said, the hell with it. I'm going to spend a little bit, not a lot of the money, about $1,000 of the money to shoot a single scene. And so there were a couple of actors that I had been working with for the sort of the meet cute scene where they start flirting, the two people. It's a romantic drama comedy thing.
Bill, I think they call those dramedies.
Yeah. A rom-dramedy.
A rom-dramedy.
And so the diner up the hill from me, a little Purity that I live at, was gracious enough to let me come in and here's your keys, lock up when you're done.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Wait, what's the diner called again?
Little Purity.
Little Purity. What a great name.
They have fantastic French toast. If you're a French toast fan, they're sort of like some of the best French toast in America. Anyway, I had the location. I had a couple of actors that I'd been working with, trying to figure out the script in this. This one scene is the one scene that is kind of pivotal and I've been fighting it a little bit. And so they came and we worked for a few hours and I said, if I ever want to, I tried to give them, you know, $100 a piece to try to, you know, work on this thing and they wouldn't take the money. And they're like, when you shoot it, you can pay us. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm.
And where does it appear in the movie? Is this early on?
This is, maybe 20% in, 10%, 15%
in. Okay. So this is, we're still setting up the overall story here.
Yeah. Yeah. So the basic gist at the beginning is that there's a photographer. This is not James, who plays the photographer, and it's not me, but there are elements of me in it. James is a photographer. He's taking headshots at a law firm. The people come in one after another.
Wait a minute.
they come in one after another after another. Hi, I'm Joe. Hi, I'm, you know, hey, I'm James. Have a seat. You know, we're going to take your picture. Cookie cutter style. A guy comes in. He's kind of a asshole. I got to go. You know, like, can you do this fast? I'll give you $20 if you do it. You know, like just one of those kinds of people. Power player. And while he's getting his picture taken and being a pain in the neck, there's a cute girl who walks up. And you can tell, you know, he looks up at her. She looks down at him, the guy in the seat. And you can tell they're sleeping with each other. So that guy leaves. The girl sits down.
Wait. The guy in a hurry that you're taking
the guy in the hurry.
Of, he's sleeping with the girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Coworkers sleeping with each other.
Ah, yeah. Okay. Okay.
So the girl sits down and she's distracted. He can't get her attention. He can't get a good picture out of her. So in an attempt to sort of get her to, you know, whatever, he said, hey, how long has that been going on between you and the last guy?
Ooh.
And she snaps a look at him and he goes, bang, bang, bang. And he's like, all right, thank you very much. Have a nice day. You know.
Nice.
And she doesn't know what hit her. Her and the coworker guy get into a little bit of a fight about stuff. She decides to go for a walk. She goes for a walk and she walks by a diner where the photographer guy is sitting at the bar. And she decides to go in and confront him. So that's the scene that I shot.
Ah.
So she comes in and is just like, hey, Mr. Photographer, like, how'd you know Edward and I were seeing each other? You know? And so and then they end up sitting down together and it gets flirty. And then he ends up saying something that offends her and she leaves. But it's enough to like set up sort of this, who is this guy? He's different than the guy at work that I am dating. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point. So we decided to shoot this scene. So I get my friend Scarlett, who's going to be a producer on my movie, like a line producer on my movie. She came. My friend Brad came and shot it.
Was it Scarlett Johansson and Brad Pitt? Yeah. Is that who your friends are?
Yeah, I wanted to keep it on the down low. And one of the things I really needed was a good audio guy. My friend Brad, who helped me shoot this, is a filmmaker, Brad Rigo. His guy, Artem, who works for him a lot of times, I texted Artem. I said, man, I know this is like way below your pay grade and whatever, and I can't really pay you that much, but, you know, would you be considered? He's like, yeah, I'm in. So Artem shows up. The actors show up. And we moved the whole diner around and we got there at 6. We set up everything until about 8 when the sun was down enough. And then we shot for 3 hours. So I shot.
And the diner's closed at this time, right?
Yeah, so the diner closes at 5 o'clock.
You have the full run of the place.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
okay.
Full run
okay.
of the place. And, you know, we shot for 3 hours. We ended up with 53 minutes of footage. We were shooting 6K Blackmagic B-Raw. So, you know, the scene is 7 pages. It ended up being, I've got a first cut. It's about 5 minutes. So I went from 53 minutes of footage down to 5 minutes of final product.
Wow.
Like 10 to 1, which is so frustrating. It's, you know, you have Jeffrey saying, are you sure? And then you have him saying, are you sure? And then, you know what I mean? You have like 17 versions. Oh, but look, his head was turned to the right in that one. I can't cross cut it with this other shot because he's turned to the left or his eyes are closed. Or, you know, those things when you're editing, right?
It ends up like the Bradley Whitford, okay, supercut.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you seen that where he's just...
Yes, exactly.
How many different ways can you say okay?
Yeah. Okay. And so, yeah. So we shot the whole thing. Not telling people what to do, like pushing them around, but just seeing a group of people execute this thing that was originally a blank piece of paper is super fun. I mean, to your earlier point of something new, right? I know I'm not Spielberg. Like, I get that. But
Spielberg wasn't Spielberg on his first, you know, short.
Well, not when he was 14, but by the time he was 17.
Yeah, it is true.
But he's a freak, right? But yeah. I understand that I'm not Spielberg, but seeing something go from a blank page to a written page to two actors acting to now we're in a location that matches, the two actors are acting, I've got lav mics on them, they've got a boom mic, we've got a 6K Blackmagic cinema camera shooting raw, we lit the place, we did, you know, all of that. And watching it happen, and I don't like saying action and cut, it's just weird to me. So like once the camera and the audio is rolling, it's like, okay, go ahead. You know,
yeah. It's like Clint Eastwood does the same thing. He doesn't say action or cut.
Yeah.
And when you're ready.
Yeah, exactly. And so we did this thing, we shot it a bunch. I came home with the footage and, you know, people, my friends, and I hope they don't get mad at me for saying so, but like most of the people involved wrote me later and said, you know, thank you for that. You know, I haven't had that much fun in a long time, you know, because it was the act of us just being together, making a thing.
Whether this goes anywhere, whether it goes to, you know, Sundance or you know, Santa Barbara Film Fest, whatever it is, whether it goes somewhere or whether it doesn't, that experience has to be incredibly both satisfying and motivating at the same time, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. But it's funny because I said to somebody, was it to you? I texted somebody and I said,
what you're going to say.
I said, you know, I would do it all the time if it wasn't so damn expensive.
Yes.
It's like a drug, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I had a really great time for 5 hours, but it cost me $1,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
you're mainlining celluloid.
Exactly.
At that point.
You know, and we're shooting digitally and I'm paying people a fraction of what I should be paying them.
Yeah. You're not even covering a craft service budget on a music video at this point.
No,
yeah,
I was just saying, you know, you're here for 5-6 hours. I understand you're doing me a favor. I understand you enjoy doing this too, but here's a couple $100 just to make it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's worth
something regardless of whether it goes anywhere. That's worth something.
It's absolutely worth something, but whether or not it's successful, whether or not people like it, the fact that whatever of us got together to have this experience, assuming I don't need to make money making the movie, which I don't. You know, I mean, yes, I'd like to. It would be nice. Like, yes, but that's not why I'm doing it.
If not for you, to pay the production staff and the actors.
Absolutely. I need the money to pay the production staff. Yes, I need enough money to pay the people to make the thing. I'm not doing this so I can make a lot of money. I'm doing this to have the experience of making the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I come home and I'm editing the footage and I'll, you know, by the way, biggest time suck in the history of the universe is video editing. Like, seriously. So
especially 6K footage, right?
You put your head down, you look up, it's 4 hours later and you've edited 33 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got a two shot, 8 second clip, final cut. And that's it.
Yeah. It's just, it's so mind numbing. I mean, not in a mind numbing. It's not mind numbing. It's kind of flow state, right? You just get into this thing where you're just like, wait. It's almost like playing memory where you're like, wait, I know there was a take where he sneezed before the thing. Wait, where is that?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're searching through the footage to try to find, oh, that could fit over here. And maybe I extend the audio from the last clip over. So, you know.
And are you working with anyone at this point? Or are
this
you
is just me?
This is you and a monitor.
I'm working with me and this guy, Bill.
Okay, James.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'm using, I've edited a bit in Resolve over the years, but I haven't in a while. So now I'm like, wait, how does that work again? Oh, right. You know, and I'm kind of hacking my way through it.
But even that sounds like there was discovery and joy.
Absolutely. That's why I said the new software thing earlier.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes the tools kind of give you inspiration. And I'm not saying you have to buy a bunch of stuff, but certainly when it comes to software stuff, it's like, right. There's that way of doing it, especially working in a totally different medium.
Yeah.
But, you know, I found myself, and this is the point of this all, I found myself while editing and I would sit back and I would play 30 seconds of it or a minute and 5 seconds of it or whatever I had edited at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd find myself smiling.
Mm.
Like at the end of it, I could like feel my face pulled back in a smile. And there were
which
a few
tells
moments.
You're on the right track, even if it's only a brief track.
Yes.
There's something about that makes it worth doing.
Yes. Yeah. And then, you know, as you and I have talked about, it's so rare that I actually am smiling.
Yeah.
In a way like that. I mean, I'll make a joke, you know, like I laugh and smile like everybody. But that sort of deep, there actually is a purpose and a reason for all of this kind of smile.
Yeah.
It's rare.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so 5 minutes and 5 seconds in, and, you know, I sent it to an editor friend of mine last night for her to take a look at it.
As just give me a gut check on does this flow
am I crazy
and work
here?
And all that? Yeah.
And she writes me back and she says, you know, can I email you my comments? And I was like, oh God, you know.
That's like, too much for a text.
Yes. And so
I'm gonna need a bigger boat.
And so I said, sure, but maybe we could get together and we could talk it through. She's like, well, I have a cold right now, so maybe by phone.
I don't have that much time, Bill.
Yeah,
is
kind
the
of.
Thing.
Yeah. And so she said, I have a cold right now. You know, can we do it by phone? And I said, FaceTime. And I said, now or later? She's like, oh, actually, now. So I called her. And she comes on FaceTime and she watched the thing. And she actually was just like, no, she's like, it totally works. It's good. She's
very
like,
cool.
I would change this. I would change the pacing at the beginning. I would try this. But a lot of the things, a lot of recommendations she made were commenting on moments in it that I had no other choice to do except what I did. You know, there are times
because
when it's like,
that's what you shot or what were the constraints there?
Well, so, you know, I had, for example, there's a part of it, like 2/3 of it, they're sitting at a table talking to each other. So I have a two shot of the two of them at the table. We did that twice, but one of them, the focus was a little off, so I can't use that take. So I have to use almost all the first take. And so if there's something I don't like in that and I need to cut to coverage of one of the other ones, one of them talking, you know, like a single shot of them talking over a shoulder or something.
Yeah. I
have a couple takes of each of them doing it. So I'm limited by the amount of footage I have. You know, we shot for 50 minutes. We only did 2 takes of anything, of any particular shot. because I wanted to keep it moving. And this is just a, you know, this isn't the final final thing. This is just, you know, a fun proof of concept.
Yeah.
So there were a few moments where it's like, shoot, I don't have a shot of her. She leans forward in that shot, and the next shot on the two shot is her with her back to the back of the chair. You know, it's like, I can't cut between those because it's really obvious, you know.
Can you do pickups at all or no?
I mean, I don't think I need to. I have enough in there that I could, I made it work. But any comments that she had were things that I thought, I know I had, I wanted to do that too. I just didn't have the footage. So I did this, you know, and she was like, you know. But when I'm done, and I think I'll be done, I sent it to a guy who's going to help me with some music, a friend of mine. You know, I sent it to these people and both of them were like, yeah, it's good. You know, like actually good, you know, like these are, I don't know. It makes me feel like it's possible, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not completely out of my depth or out of my.
And will you put this up online as an EPK type thing?
I'll stick it up on YouTube and then I'll put it on the little Hold Still film. I think that's what it is.
.com
site. So people can go watch it if they want. I want just people to get some idea of like the pattern and the pace that I'm planning on doing. I hate saying the vibes, but just, you know what I mean? The mode of doing it, you know, cause you can read.
It's so exciting though, right? I mean, I would love to be there next time you shoot.
Okay.
If I can, it would be fun. I love seeing it come together.
Telling people, you know, oh, make sure you land on this word, make that a little hard. Cause actors want those kinds of inputs.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do the next take and they do it the way you asked. And it's like, wow, that's kind of amazing that they're, I mean, people are, the big lesson here is that people are really good at what they do.
Yeah.
People are good at what they do. Just let them do what they do and let them cook. Cause like that's where you're going to get what you want to get.
And if you can let go of the performance, not performance, that's the wrong, well, maybe it is, performance of the piece as a whole. If you can let go of like, well, if it doesn't hit this or if it doesn't do this, and just keep yourself in that state of smiling as you're working through it.
Sure.
Man, I think it's going to be great. Well, I really do, regardless of where it lands industry wise.
Yeah, Scorsese said, like I'm not comparing.
When you were talking the other day,
no, I was watching a documentary. I think it's on Apple. He just said, you know, there's the movie on the page, there's the movie the day you're shooting it, and then there's the movie that you get in the edit.
Yeah,
and you know, even this, there are moments between them that when they're performing it, maybe they pause for a second or two before they say the next line. And you can, if in editing with the right footage, you can drag that out to 4 or 5 seconds. You know, you really are creating a performance in the edit as much as they were creating it on the day.
Yeah.
You know, you can, oh, they were smiling in this thing and then they're pissed in this next moment. Those weren't in the same take, but you can create that in the edit.
Yeah.
It's also kind of crazy. I'm editing on a M1 Max MacBook Pro with 64 gigs of RAM. So it's a pretty super.
Still a very robust machine.
A very robust machine.
Yeah.
But, you know, 6K RAW with, I don't know, 6 or 8 nodes of color on it with, you know, a couple, some audio stuff, EQ, compression, that kind of stuff, just to tighten things up a little bit.
Are you able to play that back in real time?
Oh, yeah.
With all of that? Yeah. Okay.
Like nothing. At butter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is what's, it's just crazy, you know? Oh, yeah. Here's a nerdy thing for you. So I get the boom mics and the lav mics, all what's the word I'm looking for when you get anyway, I get the audio files, these wave files of these things.
Yeah.
And I put them in. There was time code, by the way, which is awesome. So there's the on camera audio, and then you bring it all in. You bring those video clips and you bring the audio clips into Resolve, and you select them all, and you right click and you say align audio, or whatever it is, append audio,
and it'll syncs all the time code.
Yeah, using time code, it just adds them as additional audio tracks to all of the video files.
Oh wow!
It did fast, Jeffrey. It didn't even show me a a progress bar.
Really?
I thought it hadn't. No nothing. I thought it hadn't worked.
Wow.
Until I like pulled them down, and all of a sudden everything has like six audio tracks. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Okay.
And so is that M1 Max or is that great optimization by Resolve?
I think that's just time code. You know what I mean? Okay. Just because it's just numbers, you know, match number, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
But here's the crazy thing. So I'm looking at it and you pull up the boom mic and you pull up the lav mic a little bit. And a lot of times it's like a blend of the two, right? That you really want because you want a little chest from the lav, but you want the presence of the room from the boom. So I'm playing with that. And I noticed that I'm getting some like comb filtering. And I was like, wait a minute. If the boom is moving up and down or is in different distances, depending on the shot or turning or whatever it is, you're going to get phasing. Like the time it took to get to the one mic and get to the other mic is different.
Fraction of a millisecond or whatever. Yeah.
Is enough to get those things out of phase. So I zoom all the way into the waveform and, you know, they're offset from each other a little bit.
And does Resolve allow you? I'm sure it does, right? It allows you to plug in a frame offset or something?
You can. There's a number of ways to do this. One is just to flip the polarity of one of them. Sometimes that snaps it enough that it's close enough. It worked a little bit, but not really. And I was thinking to myself, man, I wonder if people go in and actually nudge these things manually. And apparently, as I did when I did a bunch of research, people who are really serious about this stuff, they're going in and matching the polarity by hand for each clip.
Oh my god!
Until 4 years ago, and there's a $399 plugin that does this.
And it inside of Resolve,
inside of Resolve or inside of Pro Tools.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to spend $400 on a single plugin to do this, but
the whole movie.
Well, maybe when I get to that point. But the interesting thing about it is that. It won an Emmy and an Oscar the year it came out, this plugin.
The plugin won the Emmy.
Right.
Wow.
Like a technical Emmy or
whatever? Technical Emmy. Yeah.
So, wow. so you got to imagine that the people in sound departments were like, oh my God, thank you. Right. You know?
That's funny.
And so, so now I got to go in. One of my next sort of things to do is actually go try to get rid of a little bit of the
phase. Can you imagine nudging... you know, 5-channel or 7-channel audio for a film.
Yes. Ugh. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I'm sure it's some assistant's job to do that, right? It's, woof, as the kids say.
Yeah.
It's,
do they say that though?
All the time. My kids are dogs. No. But anyway, enough of this story. But just to say that, yes, it was super fun. Yes, the technology stuff is really fun.
I'm so glad you're doing it. I really am. I mean, it like I said, if for nothing else, to get that smile that you described.
I will say that. So I do have this M1 Max. It is fine. It's great. I'm worried about the price of SSDs and RAM right now, which, you know, have quintupled in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
And I'm worried that when whatever contracts Apple has with Samsung and Hynix or whatever it is are up and they lose their price advantage, if the prices of all these laptops is going to go through the roof. And so I've been thinking about buying a new one.
Apple used to be the big player. Now they're just a player. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think they are still a really big player. I think that it's just like if the people who are building AI data centers are willing to pay twice as much, that's who they're going to sell to, you know?
Yeah. I read a thing the other day on MacRumors that they may start getting chips from Intel.
Yeah. Intel is going to
from
be
a manufacturing.
Fabbing some chips. I think some of them are less of the super high end chips just because they don't have the facilities. But do you think it's crazy to. I spec'd out an M5 Max, 64 gigs of RAM and 4 terabytes of drive space. Like if I'm going to do it, I'm going to get more internal drive space. And it's like almost $5,000 laptop. But I could sell the one I have currently. They sell on eBay for about $1,600. So now it's like a $3,500 upgrade. But it would last me another 5 years. Like this one has lasted me for 5 years.
It would. Yeah. I mean, look, you are not. If you, okay, My advice would be if you're going to do stills only, no. But if video is going to be any part of your workflow moving forward, why not?
Yeah. I mean, the video, it's funny because, I mean, this video plays back fine on this. There's nothing that I haven't hit anything that makes me, but I'm also not doing a lot of noise reduction. I'm not doing a lot of, there's like, you know, there's face retouching tools that track
in
the
Resolve
face.
Now. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, really?
And
oh,
you
wow.
get you
Is
can,
that new with 21 or
nah,
was it in 20
it's been,
as well?
I think, in the last few versions. So you just, you stick this plugin on, you track somebody's face, and then you can go in and lighten up their eyes or have an eye light on them or change the shape, skin smoothing of the forehead, of the blah, 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 like all this stuff in real time.
Wow.
If you have enough powerful enough computer. It's just crazy. So anyway, this is to say that if anybody out there happens to be an Apple employee and wants to give me a friends and family discount, let me know.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it's for your particular situation.
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, if you've got the money.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think the use case, I think your particular use case definitely warrants it.
Yep.
You know, I mean, for somebody like me, no, doesn't warrant it.
Yep.
But, you know, I'm doing stills occasionally. The bulk of my computing is writing, which I can do on a Neo.
And your M1 is fine for all that
stuff. M1's fine. It's great. Yeah. The only, it's not the processor that bottoms out. It's RAM. Because I'm only using 16 gigs of RAM. So, you know, I could get an M4 or an M5 with 32 gigs of RAM, let's say, and nothing additional, and it would be fine.
Oh, that, you know? I mean, that would scream.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of waiting for the M5 mini to drop.
Do you know that you're RAM limited? Do you actually know that for a fact?
I've looked at when I'm getting the beach ball or when things feel a little sluggish, I'll bring up activity monitor and there's definitely RAM pressure in the yellow.
Oh, okay.
And I'm starting to use swap. So things slow down.
Yeah. Okay. So it actually, you actually have evidence. Yeah. See, that's the reason why I want to make sure I have at least 64 gigs of RAM again, because I've never had that problem and I'm glad I like that I never have a RAM problem.
I mean, the OS just idle. Sequoia with nothing running is using just under 8 gigs of RAM.
Right. So that's the half your RAM right there.
Yeah. So now you add, you know, Affinity and Resolve. Let's say you're using those two together. Well, it's not going to take very long before you start getting RAM pressure and start using swap.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still fine. It still works because macOS is really incredible at optimizing memory, both compression and decompression, and then using swap. But it's nothing like, I mean, it's physics, right? It's it's nothing's going to be faster than RAM.
Yeah. So. It's, I mean, that's the annoying thing. If this was the best computer that the one I have is the best computer available right now, it would probably, it's the one I'd have and it would be fine for what I'm using it for.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that there are computers that are 2 to 3 times faster at everything.
Well, and the M5, it's the GPU cores. Each one of those GPU cores has Neural Engine on it, and it's
the M5 Max
supposedly
screams.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got to figure that out.
Yeah,
not a big deal, but something I've been thinking about. Last week, my friend had a box of slides of his family that his cousin had found or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to scan them. So we went over to my friend Matt's house, Matt Carr's house, to shoot them. And Matt has like a little Leica copy stand with an R5 Canon on it, you know? And so, you know, you backlight the slide. It is amazing how good Kodachrome slides still look.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but a lot of the Ektachrome stuff has faded in weird ways, you know, like the dyes have shifted. But the Kodachrome stuff looks exactly like it looked back in the day.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. But it made me want an R5 because that's a really nice little camera. It's cute as hell. A lot of resolution. It's fast.
And what do they go for? $2,000-$3,000 for a body? Or are they higher than that?
Used, you can get them for about $2,000.
That's not a lot of, I mean, it's.
No. It's for what
it's
it
not,
is.
It's not out of the range, you know.
45 megapixel camera that. Almost you can't miss autofocus even if you want to.
And does it do any sort of sensor stitch high res thing like the Sony's do, or is it 45
I don't know, but I never do I mean, I very rarely am on a tripod like that, so I don't usually do those things.
I was just thinking for scanning. Is he scanning them at that standard 40?
Well, I mean, there's just not that much more than 45 megapixels in a 35 millimeter slide.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
At the point at which you're taking pictures of grain.
Yeah.
You know, which you are at that point.
That grain looks great.
Yeah. Wow, that grain's really sharp. You know, when you're in the dark room and you use the like reticle thing so you can actually focus down to the grain?
Yep.
Oh, what a satisfying feeling that
is. It's a really lovely experience. It really is. I mean, the abstraction of that photograph you're looking at it's almost better than the real photograph.
And you're doing the focus and you're just like, I am focused so well on this picture that I'm focused on the substrate of that the picture is on.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so good. All right. Did you have a photographer of the week? You had somebody in mind the other day.
I do. And this is on the back of my Gary story earlier. When I got lost in the Library of Congress, I found myself standing in front of Jerry Mulligan's horn. There's a whole big display. It's got his saxophone and his Grammy and a bunch of photographs. And then right behind me, they have a small one room exhibition. William P. Gottlieb.
Okay.
All right. William P. Gottlieb. Yeah. A bunch of jazz photos from like the 40s and 50s. The plaque there is shown here is a selection of Gottlieb's photograph drawn from his collection, now held by the Library of Congress and consisting of nearly 1,800 images. The photographs are notable for Gottlieb's ability to capture personalities of his subjects, and they are an important contribution to the documentation of mid-20th century American culture. Most of the photographs from the Gottlieb collection are available on the library's website. The decade from 1938 and 1948 witnessed the zenith of the swing era and the advent of modern jazz. During this time, journalist William P. Gottlieb, 1917 to 2006, interviewed most of the outstanding active jazz performers, chiefly at venues in Washington, D.C. and New York, initially for articles appearing in the Washington Post, and later for Downbeat and Record Changer. Largely self-taught as a photographer, Gottlieb purchased a camera and photographed his subjects because the Washington Post was unwilling to pay a photographer to take pictures for Gottlieb's articles.
Wow.
And just incredible. Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday.
Yeah, Louis Armstrong, Charlie Parker.
Louis Armstrong, yeah. Nat Cole.
Yep.
There's a great photo of... here, I'm going to send this to you, of the Nat Cole trio. Just fantastic. Bill Wadman. Dunk. There you go.
Let me see. Oh, yeah.
And one of the classic photos of Sinatra. Here we go. Look at that one. At the mic, probably at, you know, some little smoky club somewhere. But just... a fantastic collection. So I spent a few minutes just wandering around in there and kind of, you know, ogling over these beautiful photographs from the 40s and 50s.
You know, it's interesting here on his Wikipedia entry, it says, hold on a second, I just moved away from it.
But I love that he shot photographs because the Post wouldn't pay him.
Yeah. Well, it just goes to show you that.
Some things never change.
Yeah. It shows you that... We used to think that things were so enlightened and whatever, but really it was the same battle in the past as it is today. In accordance with his wishes, Gottlieb's photographs were placed in the public domain in 2010. Many are used in Wikipedia and other public domain freely licensed venues. So he was cool enough to say, you know what? When I die,
these are important. Yeah.
Put it
Go
all
ahead
in
and
the,
use them.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I love that.
Yeah, I do too. 89 years old, lived until 89. 2006 he died, 2017 to 2006. He was born in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Really
fun.
Yeah.
And one of the cool things about the Library of Congress is if you want to sit with any of those photographs and talk with someone about them, they will pull, if they're not, you know, obviously in an exhibition or anything, they'll pull those photographs and you can talk with a curator and kind of sit with them and look at them in person.
Apparently he was married to a woman whose father was a trade unionist, Jacob Potofsky.
Mm.
He was the second president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. Communist. I'm just kidding.
Wow.
I'm sure at the time it was a problem.
God. God, you're just so dismissive. Communist.
Kids nowadays and their communism.
That's right.
This is very
you and
good.
Your isms.
anybody have anything to say to us? What podcast at ontakingpictures.com?
Yep.
It worked. We got some good emails this week, actually.
Yeah.
Very, very heartfelt, insightful. I feel like we're hitting a nerve.
Yeah, keep them coming, please.
Just love like the nerve them. My dentist hit in my teeth last Thursday.
Yeah. I called Bill the other day. Hey, what are you doing? I'm at the emergency dentist. I'm getting a crown.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay. I'll let you go.
You know, you go in for what you think is going to be a medium size cavity, and your dentist, who is your friend who you trust, you know, more than anything, says, yeah, it's worse than I thought, and we have to do a crown.
We need to break this apart. Yep. And but okay, very quickly.
Yep.
How did they make the tooth, Bill?
Well, see, normally in the old school days, you would actually have to do an impression and then come back a week later for them to fit it, and then come back a week later for them to put it on, and blah, 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 blah. And you have a temporary crown in the meantime. My dentist, Julie, said, if you have 2 hours, I can do it all right now. And they 3D scan what's left of your tooth once they drill all the stuff out. And then they 3D print. Actually, it's not 3D printing. It's actually a subtractive process, right? They're, they're 3D. I don't know. What would that be? You're starting with a block and then you're cutting it away.
Like a CNC machine type thing.
That's exactly like that. Of this material that when it comes out, it's blue.
Hmm.
And she fitted it on. She's like, yep, fits perfect. And she's like, all right, 20 more minutes. And it goes into an oven and it hardens in the oven.
Oh, wow.
Into a ceramic. And then
so it's basically like a shrinky dink.
Yeah. And it was funny when she was, but it doesn't lose any shape, right? Or any size, right? And then when she put it in, I said, how do you make sure that there's no space in there? Because like, whatever's left of the tooth and then whatever's left, the crown thing going on top, you got to imagine anything that gets in there is just going to rot everything away, right? Like it has to be.
Yeah.
So it's got to be super clean. And then you got to put the thing on. And I said, do you put bonding stuff in there? Whatever. She goes, no. It's the cement that does that. And I said, you know, In the computer world, I would say that it's kind of like on a CPU and a heat sink, and you have the thermal paste.
Thermal paste, yeah.
That like fills all of the
basically, your mouth is filled with Arctic silver.
Yes. And I said that to her, and she started laughing. She goes, yes, that's exactly what it's like.
That's
and I guess
funny.
It squeezes out a little bit on the side, and then they have to, you know, grind away.
That's funny.
But in the end, apparently, you know, it's calmed down a bit. She was texting me the other day because she's my friend. She's like, how's your tooth? And I was like, well, it's getting better. She's like, it should be good by now. And it's like, it's getting better. It's not quite there. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I wouldn't chomp down on nuts on that tooth yet. But, you know, hopefully she saved my tooth. But
There's a kid I saw. I read an article about this kid, 20-something-year-old kid, has developed so there are a couple kinds of 3D printers. There's a filament printer, which uses the big spools of filament. And then there's a resin printer that the plate is submerged in resin, and then it builds, uses UV light to cure the resin layer by layer. And the build plate kind of rises up as it's printing. This kid has developed a printer, a 3D printer that uses multiple types of resin. And it cleans the part before submerging into the next. So he's able to 3D print dentures and is partnering with dental association. I think the ADA and some independent dentists doing testing right now to be able to 3D print these things out of resin in the shop, wherever it ends up being deployed.
It is kind of amazing.
So cool.
It's also amazing how cheap 3D printing is. I mean, even I know you have sort of one of your own, right? That you've
I was gifted one by a neighbor of mine. Yeah. But you can buy one for a few hundred dollars.
Yeah, but even if you don't want to, you could just take a model and ship it. And like, what material do you want it in? When do you want it? Like, what color? Yeah. Like, it's kind of crazy that we've gotten to the point where you can custom order 3D printed parts for things.
Yeah, there's a place that it's a sponsor of one of the videos I was watching. They do custom printing and custom PCB boards. You can send them what you, and they'll fab you, you know, PCB boards for your project and send them back to you.
Sure. Yeah, as one does.
Fascinating.
I'm going to design a PCB board.
Yeah, right.
What? Who does this? We will we'll talk to you soon. You got anything else?
No, that's good. That's it. Okay. Get them on their commute or wherever it is that you people are going.
One more time, podcasting at ontakingpictures.com. Or no.
No, not podcasting. What the hell?
Podcast at ontakingpictures.com. We'll send us an email to both of us.
Look for Bill's new film blog. If you don't like B-roll, you mentioned it, you could call it B-raw as well. Oh,
God. I'm going to get sued by Blackmagic. And yeah, if anybody wants to hook me up with some friends and family Apple discount, let me know.
Yeah, let him know, because that M5 Max is calling his name.
Well, you know, if I could get it for $500 less or whatever the hell it is, that's something.
What's the Apple friends and family? 10%? 20%?
It's got to be pretty good. Let's see. Apple friends and family discount is 15%.
That's pretty good.
15% of $5,000 is a lot of money.
Yeah, it's not $750
bucks, right?
Yeah, why not? All right, make it happen, people. Come on now.
Come on, let's use the On Taking Pictures
hook a host
army.
You know, maybe Bill will shoot you off a print or something to say thank you.
Oh, I'll definitely do that.
There you go. Yeah.
All right, well, have a good day.
All right, talk to you later.
Bye.
Going on and on the way we are for so something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will lay me out. So I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way we tried to make it